I was living in a devil town. I didn't know it was a devil town.
What's up, junkies? This is Ralph Amson with the Devil's Junkie Podcast. We are here to talk some Sun Devil football, some Sun Devil basketball. We still got Chili, we still got Brett Quintine. We're just switching up the format a little bit to bring you more on the topics that you like. Unlike the Arizona State game, we're going to try to have two strong halves of this podcast. So let's get right into it. Chili, Brett, talk to me about the game. Where were you?
Where was I? I was here. Here, not so much the studio, but I was here in the Phoenix area. And there was a lot of college football that day. Obviously, that game, of course, caught our attention. But more so, what I found kind of just crazy, the Bay Area had two game-winning field goals that night. Obviously, Stanford winning a couple of hours earlier over Notre Dame. Cal finishing off ASU. So I was in the friendly confines watching a pair of teams lose heartbreakers.
And Chili, I was at your place after we watched four straight high school state championships.
Right.
We dove right into that ASU game.
Again, I'm left out.
Oh, no, man,
always,
nah.
But continue.
never yes. Left out. But yeah, so we were at my house watching the game. And, you know, it was typical. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it a lot more in depth. But, yeah, no, I had a blast watching all those high school football games. Hopefully some prospective Devils. Especially one Byron Murphy. So, yeah, it was exciting. I always have fun.
So let's go ahead and jump right into that Cal game. And one thing that stood out to me, you know, you have a great first half. You go into halftime up 17. You give up 38 in the second half. You end up losing on a field goal. And one of the things that stood out to me after the game was Todd Graham's post-game comments. Obviously, a lot of people were going to want to know what he had to say after what amounts to a disappointing season and a disappointing end to that Cal game. And before we get into Todd Graham's comments, I just want to put it out there to you. What do you feel like went right in the first half, and what went wrong in the second half, Brett?
Devin Lucien went right. 200 yards total, three TDs. They were clicking in the first half. They came out like they wanted it. Like they really were like, hey, you know what? We're going to a good bowl game. They still might, who knows. But they played like a team possessed, and they moved the ball. They did what they had to do, and they built that nice lead. And then half two came along, and it didn't go well.
Yeah, you know, it was definitely a tale of two halves. The first half, Sun Devils' offense was crazy. They picked up right where they left off the week before. The second half, the defense was crazy. Like Jeffrey Dahmer didn't know what to do. They were just, it was insane. I don't even know how to describe what I watched in the second half defensively or really offensively, because the offense decided not to kind of come back out either, so to speak. Went up 17 in the first half, and I do not know how you lose that game. It's
nightmare.
Insane.
I mean, if we had to describe it in one word, the second half was a nightmare. I mean, Jared Goff truly did what we thought he would do. Not necessarily in that game, but he showed what he's capable of. And he pretty much embarrassed the ASU defense.
Well, let's talk about Jared Goff real quick. I'm going to put this out there. Is Jared Goff the best quarterback in college football?
No.
Who would you say? And maybe you see someone that the Devils have faced this year. I doubt you'd say somebody like Kyle Allen or somebody from one of the lower level teams.
But he's in that state.
But,
the guy I have in mind is in that same state as Kyle Allen. To me, none other than Trevon Boykin. Boykin is, excuse my French, he's a badass.
Yeah.
It's a shame that he had that ankle injury, and it didn't favor them when they played their final game against Baylor the other night in the rain, in the mud. That's going to hamper a running quarterback, but he's not just a running quarterback. He's broken all of Andy Dalton's passing yards, so that to me is just amazing, and he has the touchdowns on the ground to boot.
I don't even know if Jared Goff is the best quarterback in the pack, to be honest with you. Statistically, he's and record-wise, he's behind Luke Falk by a little bit on yards. You know, just the way Hogan manages a game, I might take Hogan over him. Kessler, I mean, I just don't. I'm just not sold on Goff. I know the NFL is, but you know, the NFL was also sold on a whole bunch of other quarterbacks that, you know, didn't really pan out. But
He's got great numbers.
Outside the pack, I mean, besides Boykin, there's a couple other quarterbacks I take. I take the kid from Oklahoma, Mayfield. I'd probably take Watson from Clemson. I mean,
kind of Cook.
My quarterback has to win games, and I just don't.
A 7-5 QB
isn't the one for me.
Correct.
And if I am taking a quarterback that is record-wise struggling, I might take Burkow. The kid played out of his offense. He's not comfortable in this offense. He's a pro-style quarterback. So, I mean, I'd rather have him 100 times out of 100 over Jared Goff.
Absolutely. That's something that we had said consistently all year. He's not a read offense type of guy, and he still had a good year. But imagine if he was in a system that he was built to be in.
Right.
And I mean, I would say that he probably doesn't handle pressure as well as Goff obviously did in this game. But Burkow can hit a slant and have a receiver run for another 60 yards.
Oh, sure.
No, which is, I mean, if you look at Goff's 550-odd passing yards that he had, you're talking about over half of those coming after a 10, 12-yard pass.
That's true.
One defender missing a tackle and then somebody strolling into the end zone. So let's get into that pressure. Let's talk about that pressure, because probably the most interesting comments after the game was Todd Graham going into that hyperbole that he usually does, saying, "We pressure. It's mm-hmm. who we are. It's what we do. It's what we're about. It's what we're always going to be about." And then he drops this bomb: "If we didn't pressure, we'd get beat 100-0.
Yes, he did. Yes.
So I want to talk about that, because obviously you didn't get. You might have tried to pressure, but you didn't sack Goff once. Yet offensively, you put 46 up and left 24 on the board just from kicking field goals in the red zone. So I guess my question would be, with this amount of hyperbole from Todd Graham, whether it's best team ever or whether it's we get beat 100-0, do you get to a point where you're trying to make points with people and those points eventually start to get lost and your credibility comes into play?
You call it hyperbole. I call it coach speak, which is essentially the same nonsense almost. He's essentially just circling the wagon, just kind of looking for anything to latch on to. I mean, they obviously the defense really was terribly ineffective. And yes, that quote truly rang very deeply home with me of, if they didn't pressure, they would have gotten beaten, given up 100 points. Their defense, something was missing in that second half. It was, ASU's defense was not their strong point all year. But to see them collapse like that in the final regular season game of the year, it was just off and weird a little bit.
You know, I don't blame Coach Graham. You know, I kept thinking about what he said, 100-0, and I'm thinking to myself, like, you know what, if they don't blitz Goff at all, now you're talking about a kid that is just going to drop back and just hang out.
Absolutely.
And so then, you know, you're not even getting our offense back on the field.
Correct.
So 100-0, maybe not, but might the score be a little bit more out of control? Maybe.
Probably.
Maybe we don't have that 17-point lead at all.
That's very true.
I mean, you know, hyperbole, coach speak, you know, it's tough. It's tough to, you know, assess anything regarding this team when it comes to things that Coach Graham says. You know, he's just, he's been out there with a few of his comments. I don't want to say it's ruined his credibility, because let's face it, the one place that he is winning is recruiting. And you know, whatever the case is, you know, he's getting these kids. So, you know, I'm going to give him a chance. He's given us a couple 10-win seasons.
Right, and that says a lot. And he's a likable guy.
I'm going to give him a pass on this one. On this whole season, I'm going to give him a pass. Norvell gets the pass. They all get the pass. You know, this season's done. It's in the books. Now, looking back on all the things that we looked forward to, we realize a whole lot of things. Burkow wasn't the guy for this particular offense. This offense did not cater to his skill set.
Next year's guy is.
You know, I cannot wait. The boss, Bryce Perkins, he's going to get his shot. And if he doesn't, it's going to be somebody super special that does. So, there's a lot. I predicted Ellis Jefferson to get 1,500 yards receiving. So, I mean, you know, and here we are, and he's got like 15. So, you know, that's where that stands.
Well, speaking of giving somebody a pass and getting passed on, I think that we can agree the defense is a personnel issue. This is not necessarily something that's a coaching issue, at least not at its core. Defense is a personnel issue, especially in the secondary. But offensively, we're looking at a team that struggled in the red zone all year long, had absolute breakdowns that cost them the Oregon game, and left 24 points worth of touchdown and extra points on the board to kick 6 field goals and help Zane Gonzalez break some records.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know if you feel like that's also a personnel issue, or at the core of it, that comes down to coaching.
Well, I'd say offensively, I think it comes down to coaching. I mean, I would say this, and I'm going to take it several levels below youth football. I've been around some really talented kids at the 12 and 13-year-old mark, and they've transformed into some really good high school players. Some of the guys who I would rattle off, you'd be like, oh, wow, you guys had them all together. And we fell flat. And that's not necessarily on the kid. I think that's on the coaches. Sometimes I think staffs tend to overcoach and really, I don't want to say overestimate kids' abilities, but take things for granted and not really plug in the proper X's and O's. And I think that's what happened here. I mean, this was a team that should have shattered a lot of team records, but like you said, broke down in the red zone, had some costly turnovers, didn't put up the amount of points against teams that they probably should have. So I think it's a coaching scenario.
You know, the this is going to sound interesting. So the Sun Devils end the season 6-6, right?
Right.
So they end up 6-6 with Mike Bercovici at the helm. What were the options really? Manny White, Bryce Perkins? I think that Todd Graham decided to let Bercovici be the man so that Manny White could hold the clipboard, Bryce Perkins could get a year of experience learning the offense, travel with the team, get the experience of, you know, being a part of all the camaraderie and stuff like that, so that next year, either one of these two quarterbacks is going to be better prepared and better equipped mentally to take on the task of being a starting quarterback at this level. One of them is going to emerge and be elite.
Absolutely.
Quick. And, you know, what were the options? Not let Bryce redshirt, start Manny. You're looking at what, 7-5 anyways?
Sure.
I mean, I don't know that Manny Wilkins. I don't know that. I think I called Manny White a minute ago, but I think that that
situation. Neither one of them got much playing time.
I think that situation is two-headed anyways, because one of them might be out the door soon anyways. But so I think that, you know, Bryce Perkins gets a start. Like, we're still looking at 6-6, 7-5. So why not let him redshirt? Why not let him get a little bit stronger? Why not let him, you know, learn the playbook, the ins and the outs, and, you know, throw with the second and third team guys? Why not let Wilkins do the same thing and carry the clipboard and be on the sidelines and, you know, get some, you know, mop-up duty? And, you know,
because that was Graham's biggest concern at media day. He actually addressed the point of, someone asked, hey, what's your biggest concern this year? Because again, we all thought points, yardage, this team could go whatever, 13-1, 14-0, etc. He mentioned that quarterbacking was his biggest concern. Nothing against Bercovici, not at all, but this time last year, he had 9 years worth of quarterbacking experience in his top two guys. This year, yes, you had Bercovici, fifth-year senior, but then you go all the way down to Manny Wilkins, who has pretty much none, and then obviously Brady White and Bryce Perkins. So there was no depth at the QB position at all this year.
So let me see if I can actually discern this. So, Brett, you're saying coaching. Chili, am I right to say that you're saying personnel, that it's a matter of time?
On defense, I think personnel's the issue. On offense, I think coaching is the issue. Look, Bercovici had, what, 3 great games as a junior, right? He had 3 great games as a senior. He threw for almost 400 yards and 4 touchdowns against Cal. He threw for almost 400 yards and 5 touchdowns against Oregon, and he threw for 5 touchdowns against Colorado. So he had the same output this season that he did last season.
Agreed.
You know, so I'm not so mad anymore.
Let's jump into another Sun Devil quarterback, and we want to congratulate Mike Bercovici for winning Pac-12 Scholar Athlete of the Year, and we'll get more into that later. But let's talk about Brock Osweiler. I don't know if you guys were following much when he was the quarterback, when, it was fun to watch him locally, but basically anytime you got anybody, you know, in regional or national coverage, all they do is talk about his height or the fact that he had a basketball offer to Gonzaga.
Or a bad tattoo.
Or a bad tattoo. And I'll be honest, as an English major, his tattoo, it does offend me. It does offend me.
I know nothing about this, and I don't even think I want to know. You guys are talking about
tattoos. Oh, no, it's simple.
It's appropriate.
Yes. Okay. I think you would think that I'm overreacting, but he has a tattoo on his bicep. It says, live life to its fullest. Its has an apostrophe, which means live life to it is fullest.
Okay.
But hey, it is a full life, so good for him. But he left school early. He got picked up in the second round by John Elway and the Broncos. His college roommate was Jack Elway. Obviously, there was a connection there. He's from Kalispell, Montana, which, if you have never been, is one of the most gorgeous places on earth, and it is like on the Canadian border.
I can tell you there's two people at this table who have never been.
You know what? At least two. I'm from up there, but I lived on the border of Montana and Wyoming, and it's still an 8-hour drive all the way through Montana to get there. So I've never been. I'm familiar with the area, but
it's time for that boom copter to get to one of those places.
So, you know, he's an Erickson recruit. He had some success here, a losing record overall, but he goes and he waits behind Peyton Manning for the last few years. He finally gets his opportunity. He's on the cover of Sports Illustrated, which, if you remember, I think 2003 and 2005, Jake Plummer made the cover as a Broncos quarterback, and now here in 2015, we're seeing Brock Osweiler on the cover. He's 2-0. He hasn't looked like a world beater, but he's been better than Peyton was. I guess my question is, can Brock keep it going?
You know, Brock's a solid quarterback. He's a solid, you know, NFL quarterback. He held the clipboard for a little bit. So, you know, he's got, you know, I feel like anytime these guys get a chance to hold the clipboard and kind of learn under somebody, you know, it really helps him out. It did wonders for Aaron Rodgers.
Absolutely. I'm a big believer in that. You know, sitting for a year or two in the NFL at the quarterback position.
Right. I mean, even Eli Manning did it. You know, he did it for a little bit with Kurt Warner, you know, taking some starts when he was with the Giants. You know, I feel like Brock has gotten into a situation where, you know, it doesn't seem like the coaches are asking too much of him, which I know sounds crazy since the last game he just threw 42 passes, but it doesn't seem like they're asking him to do too much of himself. So
correct.
Like, they're just, you know, hey, go in there, do these things, hand the ball off to Anderson, and, you know, just get it going. Just, you know, keep the offense in a rhythm. Peyton's hurt. If Peyton's healthy, I think it's a different story.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, hopefully Osweiler can. I mean, right now, to me, he's my starter.
Right.
They're 9-2. Even if they go 2-3 the rest of the way, 11-5, still good enough to win that division. And I think Osweiler is good enough to win a couple of games. He's increased his passing yards each of the last three games. And like you mentioned, they're not asking him to do a whole lot. Just keep us moving, keep us in the game. Kind of like a pitcher. Hey, give us 6 innings. Don't get shelled. Let's let the bullpen do the work. In this case, they're asking the defense, hey, pick it up a little bit. We have, I'm going to say, an inexperienced quarterback, but he's keeping the Broncos in games, and heck, he's going ahead and winning games for the Broncos.
Right, right.
So right now, he's my guy the rest of the season, regardless of when the Broncos season ends.
Okay, so now Brock Osweiler, and it's Osweiler like Australia, but I've been calling him Osweiler because they're 2-0. All right, and okay. I feel like they can probably keep it going. But is he the best option for them moving forward? If you remember, Tim Tebow won a playoff game for John Elway's Broncos, and you have to understand, I grew up absolutely hating the Broncos. Absolutely hating the Broncos. My whole family loved them, and I just wanted to be different. Some people, you know, they rebel with a little bit of drinking, a little bit of womanizing. I just hated the Broncos. That's all I did. And then Plummer went there, and Plummer was one of my all-time favorite college players. And for 3 years, I had to kind of swallow the bitter pill. And then I watched them get rid of him for Jay Cutler. I watched them get rid of Jay Cutler. I watched them get rid of Tim Tebow after winning a playoff game. Do you think that John Elway, even with this connection, even with Brock being friends with his son, do you think that John Elway is going to look to do what's in the best interest for the Broncos regardless, or do you think he gives Brock a chance next year?
Here's my take on that. If Peyton Manning comes back next season, it's Peyton's job. No ifs, ands, or buts. If Peyton hangs him up in the offseason, now I think Elway is going to search to see what's out there. Again, I think he's comfortable with Osweiler, much like he was comfortable with Tebow, but all of a sudden Peyton Manning became available. And I'm not saying in 2016 the Broncos are looking for the best veteran out there, but he's going to think about drafting a QB because that's a situation that you can't be thin in the NFL. So if there's an opportunity to potentially upgrade, Elway will not hesitate.
I agree with you that Elway will not hesitate, but I do disagree with Duke. Elway did not like Tim Tebow. I do not think he was a fan of Tim Tebow at all, and I think that he was looking to get rid of Tebow as early as possible.
Okay.
I think, you know, since Tebow had throwing mechanic issues.
I mean, and he was certainly and off Elway was in his mechanic.
Elway was a pure quarterback. I think Elway hated what Tim Tebow brought to the table as a quarterback.
Okay.
As a leader, I think he was cool with it. Like, hey, I'm gonna let Tebow live and ride out this season. But after the season, I'm gonna banish him to the furthest reaches of the Meadowlands. I'm not gonna send him to the Giants where he could possibly win some games. I'm gonna send him to the Jets or the Eagles or one of these terrible teams.
But like, I mean, I would say if Manning was still with the Colts, I don't know if Elway would have acted that swiftly. I really think, and I can't recall the timetable. I thought it was Manning first, and then what am I doing with Peyton? Excuse me, what am I doing with Tebow? I don't think he got rid of Tebow before he had Manning in pocket. I can't recall the whole scenario.
I think that's the correct timetable. Mm-hmm. But basically what we're saying is both of you agree that Elway is going to do what's best for the Broncos, regardless of his allegiance to Brock. I think you're both in the minority opinion saying that it's Peyton's job next year. I think most people think Peyton's done for good, that this is it for him.
Yeah, I think this is
I think if he wants to come back, I think he will be welcome and open on. That's my opinion. But
if he comes back healthy, yeah.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Because, I mean, Manning's not coming back as a backup.
No, but for sure not. No
if
way.
He's, but who knows if he has hung him up for good.
Is Brock at least making himself some money right now?
You mean on the free agent market?
Yeah. If that's where he ends up. Do you think somebody's going to see him as a viable option?
It depends if
there's some
winning.
Bad quarterbacks in the league right now.
I tell you, Osweiler, technically, I'll say this. He's made himself some money by being able to hang on for a few years at the back end. I'm not sure if he gets that big, say, Matt Cassel money, whoever gave him that money while back. But I think he's made himself a name for himself. Will he be able to stay in the league a few more years because of this opportunity?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I definitely agree with that.
And you can stay in the league a long time carrying that clipboard.
Right.
Yeah, look at Matt Hasselbeck. He's 40 years old and he's won himself.
He's not carrying
no more
now. He's starting games again.
All right, so let's jump into the bowl scenarios. I have a feeling that we're going to end up playing in the Cactus Bowl. We're going to be close to home, and that's going to give. The Sun Devils a chance to get out in full force. Whatever full force looks like, I think we only saw that one time this year for the U of A game. There are options. Poinsettia Bowl, I've heard several different options in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. What would be the upside of going to Texas for one of these cruddy bowls? Would it be recruiting, or would it just be a matter of having a beatable opponent?
There is no upside going to Texas for a bowl game, in my opinion. I just don't think that, and we've talked a few times about these bowl scenarios the last few weeks, and I keep throwing out that whole Foster Farms Bowl because to me that's the typical corporate sponsor bowl game that, who plays in that? Where is that one? That sort of thing. The Cactus Bowl indeed is the most viable option for everything that we've just mentioned, being at home, just packed house, the whole potentially packed house. Going to Texas to an earlier bowl game, to me, take it off the table.
When is the Cactus Bowl?
January 2nd. So it's
so we don't have any of our student body really back yet.
Yeah, but it's also
But
here's what I think about it. It's a unique bowl. It's played at Chase Field. So anytime you're playing in a baseball stadium, a little bit different. It's a weekend night, and also just. Whomever that opponent is going to be is going to draw that, not necessarily Sun Devil fans, but I think people will come to Chase Field to watch ASU as opposed to traveling to Texas or Albuquerque.
The obvious is that we'll get more local fans.
And that's big. I think that's huge.
And, you know, we'll also get to give a proper send-off to
DJ Foster, yes.
Bercovici, and Simone. Mm-hmm. But we've won recruiting here. We own this recruiting
right,
base.
Right, but see, here's
if we go to like Texas or like even like Florida or California for one of these like littler bowls, and there's a chance to pick up a recruit or two out there, I'm all about that.
But
make
see,
next year's team stronger.
Here's my thing with a late bowl game of January 2nd. The coaches can head out to Texas and to some of these spots. And no, it's not like playing an actual game there.
Right.
But they get to use that time to maximize their 15 practices between the end of the season and the start of their bowl game. they get to maximize recruiting, not just in Texas, but all over the country. No, you're right, Chili. There's nothing like playing a game in wherever it may be, wherever you're looking for recruits. But I think they're going to maximize that time, and I think that would be better than the whole team playing in a lesser bowl. Because, and the Cactus Bowl is a lesser bowl anyway.
Just because unless I'm mistaken, I think the Sun Devils still have like 6 or 7 scholarships available.
It's probably. I mean, you could maybe make the assumption that there might be a couple of silent commits waiting to announce, but you're probably closer to 6 for this cycle, maybe 7.
So I mean, you know, if there is you know, a few recruits in a certain area, Texas or you know Florida, in these major you know markets for football, I wouldn't be mad if they decided to go that route. But staying close to home, we might get a few more fans out. And like I said, you get the proper send-off for somebody like DJ Foster who spent 4 years.
Right, and I think the recruiting obviously never ends, but I think at this stage of the game for this edition, I think it's more important to play in front of your home fans and to have that type of atmosphere potentially than going out recruiting, because recruiting can be done all over the place. It can be done on our computers.
Now let's touch real quickly on this, because the Pac-12 has been a snake eating its own tail all year long. I think everyone in the Pac-12 has probably lost a game that they regret within the conference. And I know there are a couple like Stanford who definitely regret a loss they have out of the conference. Is the Pac-12 going to perform well in its bowl matchups because of the diverse offenses, because of the quarterbacks and everything like that, and not necessarily if you're a Big Ten team or a Big 12 team or an ACC team, being familiar with guys like Falk or guys like Goff. Do you think the Pac-12 at least comes out on the other side with a winning record in polls?
I'm going to say yes. We can go detailed, but yeah, my first thought is yes.
So I'm kind of split on this. At the top, with Stanford and Oregon, I think we're okay. I think the Pac-12 wins those games. At the bottom, I also think that we're okay with the UCLAs, the USCs, the Washington States, and the Utahs. The ASU, the U of A, the Cal, and the Washington, I think those teams are going to be solid too. It's the middle of the Pac teams, the UCLA, the USCs, the Washington States, and the Utahs that I'm a little concerned about. I don't know how they match up with the... You know, just depending on what the matchups are.
I was going to say, and that's huge, the matchup scenario, and we'll be able to talk more in depth like, about this the next time around.
Like, I think the top of our conference is highly competitive. And I think the bottom of our conference is even going to be highly competitive, too, after having played this challenging conference schedule. It's just those middle teams that I'm worried about.
See, I kind of even disagree with you. I think whoever draws Iowa or Michigan State in the Rose Bowl, let's just say Stanford wins, they're going to the Rose Bowl, probably as opposed to the Final Four playoff game, they're going to take on a Michigan State or an Iowa. That presents a very tough matchup. And we'll see, win or lose. But I just think that at the top, being the granddaddy of them all, I think that presents a very tough matchup for the Pac-12 team. But yeah, the rest of everything, when you run into a Jared Goff or a Utah team that is, I'm going to say, sometimes hard to predict, I think a lot of it just plays up on matchups. Yeah.
And sometimes it's timing. Utah did get Michigan this year. Oregon played Michigan State pretty closely when they were still figuring things out. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see on that. Now let's jump into some of these coaching changes that have happened. Arizona State's rumored to have some coaches in the running for a few jobs. I know that offensive line coach Chris Thompson has been rumored to be linked to the North Texas. I think where there's smoke, there's definitely fire there, but I've heard they're going to try to give that job away to someone else here in the next couple of days, possibly an assistant from North Carolina. Now we're hearing maybe coach Chris Ball, the defensive backs coach, might be linked to Montana State. They cleaned house this year. But some coaching changes have actually gone down, and I want to talk about how those possibly impact Arizona State. So first off, what do we think of Oregon's offensive coordinator, Scott Frost, Mr. Bedsheets? What do we think of him taking his talents to UCF? Yeah.
Well, he's got his work cut out for him, because I believe UCF was 0-12 this year.
I think it was 0-13.
Was it even 0-13?
Yeah, lucky number 13,
They have some problems in Orlando, considering just 2 years ago they had Blake Bortles and they were playing in, wasn't it here, in the Fiesta Bowl or one of these? They played in a big-time bowl. So, I mean, he's got his work cut out for them. How it affects ASU, I don't think it necessarily does just as far as Yes, Scott Frost was there for 7 seasons with the Ducks in various capacities. I think they will find a way to continue that wacky offense and still be a very viable team. I don't think Scott Frost leaving has any effect on their one loss record the next couple of years.
I agree that they're going to continue their offensive trend that they've done over the past few years. I disagree. I think that this is the next phase of the Oregon slide. I think that, you know, Scott Frost isn't going to impact the win-loss column by himself. I think just having his consistency there, you know, having the same person, you know, back over and over again, you know, I don't think Helfrich properly, you know, filled the shoes of Chip Kelly, and I don't think the next person's going to properly fill the shoes of Scott Frost. You know, it might not be, you know, wins and losses this season. It might be wins and losses the next season. I talked to a lot of kids, and they really like Scott.
Popular guy, yes, because we saw him at a couple of the high school games that we've been to over the last couple of seasons. So, yes, he definitely got out there, made himself visible. But there's something about Oregon that I think they just keep those
Web legs twirling. 72 uniform combinations.
That's ridiculous. We know how I feel about uniform
combinations. Let's jump into one that possibly impacts Arizona State a little bit more. And that's USC removing the interim tag from Clay Helton and giving the people what they want just a couple years after not giving the people what they want and letting Ed Orgeron go. I mean, just what is Pat Hayden doing? It feels like it's a pendulum. He'll go to one side and then to the other. Is this a miss? Is this a be careful what you wish for situation? And how is it going to impact Arizona State, Chili?
You know, the first thing that I thought about was the situation with Orgeron. And, you know, as soon as they took the interim tag off, I thought, man, dude, like, this is exactly what they should have done, you know, before Sarkisian came in. I think that this honestly keeps USC competitive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect them to blow out ASU in the future like they did this year. But I think that this is what keeps them from becoming a 500 ball club. I think that this is good for their program, which doesn't necessarily bode well for us. I've heard that Helton's a good recruiter. So, I mean, I heard that he's good with kids.
And that's big.
So, I mean, it sucks for us. But, you know, it's going to keep the pack more competitive. So
he's been there since 2010, and yeah, like you said, it adds some stability for myself, the Trojans, and I think a lot of people. It's been hard to figure out USC between Orgeron, Sarkisian, now Helton, gone regardless of the days of Pete Carroll. But at least when they had Pete Carroll, you immediately knew who the coach was.
Right.
And now you look at kids, let's say on the East Coast, wow, who's USC's coach? They know about USC, still has that name, but there's no name that's identifiable. So if Clay Helton, now that he has an interim tag removed, they need to keep a coach in place for several years to get that Trojan brand back, no pun intended. But I definitely think that it helps USC and potentially hurts ASU a little bit in the recruiting war.
And I think we can all agree that this interim tag being removed, I mean, that's a one-year deal. He is not done earning, and that fan base is not going to be satisfied with a down year next year. So they better come ready to go. The other one, obviously, it looks like Rich Rod is staying down in Tucson. I've heard from a lot of people on the Devil's Digest message boards feel the same. The longer he's in Tucson, the more that program's going to erode, at least from a recruiting standpoint, and from the fact that it doesn't seem like he's able to swallow a lot of the bitter pills that the Pac-12 deals out, whether it's scheduling or officiating or a lot of the things that a lot of people have problems with when it comes to the Pac-12, whether it's the Pac-12 network or many other issues. So, I mean, is it good for Arizona State that Rich Rodriguez is hanging on in Tucson?
I think so for sure. How could we not like this? We beat him to tears this year. Like, I mean, we own Rich Rod for sure. So, I mean, as a Sun Devil fan, I gotta say I love that U of A is keeping him.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the fact that yes, they won this year, obviously, but U of A has been competitive the last few years. Matter of fact, they might finish with a better record than the Sun Devils this year.
True.
Both teams are 6-6. Depends on who wins or who loses their bowl game. Yeah, it does have some impact. Definitely, Rich Rodriguez seems to be sometime making noise for the wrong reasons. But I'm going to say the longer he's there, the better it is for that program. Not necessarily directly in competition with the ASU, because, yes, they're always going to be in competition. But we talked about stability with long-term programs a week ago. The longer a coach is there, the better it is for that program. Hashtag Frank Beamer.
Right, true. I agree with that. You know, stability, especially at the coaching spot, the quarterback spot,
definitely.
You know, an anchor on defense, you know, and they've been able to kind of provide that all of during Rich Rod's tenure there. So,
all right, so let's get to the rundown portion. Quick, short answers, and we'll deal with the fallout and the controversy on the DevilsDigest.com message boards. If you're not a member, please join up. You missed out on some great Cyber Monday deals, but still, it's definitely worth the $9 or so a month to go ahead, log on, be part of a Sun Devil community, learn about recruiting, you know, before everybody else gets an opportunity to, and just be able to discuss these topics, vent when you need to, and celebrate with some people that you like when you need to as well. I'm in there, Brett's in there, Chili as well. So let's get to this one real quick. I don't need much explanation, but I want to say, outside of ASU, which Pac-12 teams exceeded your expectation, and do you feel like ASU is objectively the most disappointing team in the Pac-12?
I do think that they were the most disappointing, because back in mid-August, nationally, they were talked about making the playoffs. I just think there was a lot expected of this team, perhaps too high, but they certainly, in most people's eyes, especially with that offense, a lot of people felt that this is going to be a Sun Devil team that wins numerous games, 40-14. And for them to be 6-6, not even a 8-4 type of team, 6-6, could even face a losing season, they are a big disappointment.
Man, you know, if you would have told me at the beginning of the season this team was going to be 6-6 at this point, I would have said that you were crazy. And I know I've said that a couple times during the season. Like, every time they're hovering around 500, it seems like I say that. I fully expected this team to be a 9-10 win team. And part of that was believing the hype. And part of that was, you know, and I don't mean this to sound bad, because it's going to come out way worse than I really mean it. Part of it was believing in Burko. This isn't the offense for him. And
correct.
When you have somebody that's not comfortable running the show,
right.
These are the results that you get.
Because I was waiting for the typical... And he passed for a lot of yards, 3,500 yards or so. But each week I kept expecting 300 yards and two nice TDs, one to Ellis Jefferson and maybe one to Lucien. I expected the drop back type of scenario. And like you said, running the show was not, it's not his game.
So, you know, man, I'm not as disappointed as I thought I would be after this whole season played itself out. You know, there were some heartbreakers in there. The Cal game was a heartbreaker. The A&M game was a heartbreaker. But this team showed flashes of brilliance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hit the nail right on the head early, before the first whistle for kickoff came. You said it right. These two running backs, they're gonna do something special like we haven't seen before. Okay. So I give you all the credit in the world for pointing that out. And you know what? Even in a 6-6 season, we saw that.
Yes, we did. Yes.
We saw that.
That was nice.
And what are we looking forward to now next year? Not just Bryce Perkins starting, but we're looking to see Balazs and Richard show out.
Absolutely.
Now I know you're an optimist, and we do want to make some of these topics quick, and so you keep coming back to the bright spots, but put it out there. Is ASU the most disappointing team in the Pac-12?
No.
Who beats them?
If I'm down south in Tucson, I'm really hurt that this U of A Wildcats team is just terrible.
You can't blame it on injury, Anu Solomon, concussions, things like that. They had all their defense.
We had injuries. You know, the Sun Devils had injuries last year when they won 10 games. Sometimes you deal with those things.
Yeah, that's true.
Notre Dame had an injury at quarterback, and look what they did.
That's true. All right, so let's get into this a little bit more. The Pac-12 put their awards out there. Antonio Longino doesn't even get a sniff, doesn't even get honorable mention when he leads in tackles for a loss, in sacks. Salamo Fiso has a great year. Basically Christian Westerman is the only person on any of the first or second teams. And I know that a lot of people were offended by that, but there's probably an equally sized group that said, why do we deserve awards when we had a season this bad? Obviously, these are individual awards, and so you're judging individual performances. Shouldn't be tied to a team's success. Some people thought, because the coaches voted on this, this might even be some retaliation for signal stealing. There's all sorts of conspiracy theories, but we're going to get past that. We're not going to talk about those awards. We are going to do our own awards. So I'm just going to throw an award out there, and you tell me who you give it to, okay? Offensive MVP.
Demario Richard, 1,056 yards. Who would have thought it? I mean, I kind of did, but I wasn't sure he'd have this type of an impact on this team.
I'm going with Burko. The kid played, you know, out of his element, and he played.
Okay. So we got Super Demario, and we got Burko. Let's go with defensive MVP.
Salamo Fisu. I thought he came to play every day, much like Jordan Simone did, but Fiso's still healthy, so I'm going to go with him.
And, you know, I'm going with Simone. Got to send him out the right way. And, you know, he was the captain. He was the guy.
And he was nominated for the Thorpe Award, the Defensive Back of the Year
right.
Award. He was a semifinalist, actually. So, yeah, terrific year. It ended bad for him, though. I feel worse because he's a hell of a guy.
All right. Most improved from last year to this year.
Got to go with Demario Richard again because he essentially doubled his all-purpose yards, almost. I mean, he increased by a couple hundred in receiving. He increased by about 500 on the ground. So, yeah, I would not have thought that he would take this big of a jump.
And you're obviously saying maybe even from the beginning of the year to the end because he obviously mm-hmm. had fumbling issues.
Yes.
But seemed to have solved
yeah.
those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Chili?
I'm going with Richard also. Balazs was close, but... you know, Brett pointed out, you know, he doubled his rushing yards, and, you know, I have Richard down for most improved.
All right, best offensive newcomer, and I hope you don't surprise me on this. I feel like I know where you're going, but Chili likes to throw surprises out there. Who's the best offensive newcomer?
I'm going with Lucien. He came on in the second half. Like, you can't even deny that. I was a little disappointed during the first, you know, 5-6 games, but, you know, he really turned it up for real. So I got to go with Devin Lucien.
Yeah, 390 yards over the last couple of weeks. He had numerous touchdowns. Yeah, Devin Lucien, not new to college football, but new to the Sun Devils, so he qualifies.
So if he doesn't blow up over those couple of games, do you go Tim White?
Yes.
Maybe.
All right. So best defensive newcomer?
Kareem Orr, true freshman. 5 picks, 31 tackles. He was a... it took me a while to realize that he was actually a true freshman watching him. It's like, oh, wow, that kid is a freshman. And he's not a redshirt freshman. So to me, he really played just very well, held his own in a passing conference.
Yeah, I'm going the same direction on that. Orr was fantastic, you know, for, you know, being a true freshman. And you can't disagree with that.
The player it will, and it just doesn't have to be on the field, this can be all around, but the player it will hurt most to lose to graduation.
I'm definitely going to say DJ Foster. He didn't have the numbers that we had hoped this year, but he's a guy who is kind of that glue. He was just steady. He was there for 4 years, year in, year out. You knew that Foster was going to have an impact in some way, shape, or form. He took over leadership in his back couple of years. So, yeah, DJ Foster is going to be missed.
No disrespect to DJ Foster. I didn't go that direction because I feel like he kind of paved the way to bring in Chase Lucas and Nikhil and Bryce Perkins and keep some of these kids at home. So I feel like his legacy is going to stand so we won't miss him. I went with Berkovici because he played out of his position and not once did he, like, complain about it. He always took the rap for it. He blamed himself for the Oregon game. You know, he's such a stand-up dude, like,
he is
in all aspects. So,
you're not one of those guys in his Twitter mentions telling him to jump off a bridge, is what you're saying.
No, I want to see Berkovici succeed at the next level. And I want him to show everybody that he can play the quarterback position. He just can't play a read option offense.
Correct.
And I'm not mad at him for that.
All right, last couple. And I'm going to put a condition on this one. Biggest upside for 2016, you cannot say Bryce Perkins. Because you can't guarantee that he'll start. Chili, you're going to end up in an Ellis Jefferson situation 2 years in a row. So outside of Bryce Perkins, biggest upside for 2016.
Regardless, youth will be served. We're going to be young at the quarterback position. That's the best thing for ASU's program right now, is that we get somebody fresh in there, somebody who hasn't been around the program for a long time, somebody that's learned under Berkovici, somebody that's, you know, seen how bad it can really get so that they know what they want. So I think, you know, youth will be served for sure. We got a lot of good young Arizona kids coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Nikhil Harry, Chase Lucas, hopefully Byron Murphy. We're going to be tough. We're going to be young, and we're going to be scrappy. Those players like that, they're hungry, and they want to win here. That's important.
For me, it's Tim White. He'll be the leading receiver coming back. And you mentioned someone who studied under Berkovici. Yes, Bryce Perkins potentially. Well, obviously he studied under, but Tim White caught touchdown passes from Berkovici. So I think he will be the leader of the receiving corps next year.
I mean, a topic for a later podcast, and I don't want to get into it now, but you put Tim White on the field at the same time as Cam Smith, and you have two burners, and all of a sudden you're in a position where do you need to play the quarterback that gets the ball down the field farthest and with the most accuracy, and that maybe puts you in a situation where Bryce Perkins isn't the best option. But we'll get into that. We'll get into that later. We'll go with best in-game moment for you from 2015.
Without a doubt, it was Kalen Ballage's run in the Rose Bowl. He dragged the whole kitchen sink with him, 8 UCLA guys on top of him, and still made his way into the end zone for a touchdown. So, yeah, that's – and, Chili, just looking at you, I think you thought of that as well. And
yeah.
I think we can agree.
Yeah, there's no question. That's definitely the biggest in-game moment. That was crazy. And that also gave the Sun Devils so much hope.
It did. Like, at the time, nice quality win at UCLA put them over the 500 mark, if I'm correct at that point. So, yeah, that was fantastic.
All right, so let's get into this. this is a tough task for anyone. Some controversial issues, but I'm going to see if I can get you in one word. If you have to use 3 or 4, I will understand. But based on their 2015 performances, describe the following with one word. Okay, we'll start with this. ASU's coaching staff.
Displaced.
Suspect.
Wow, all right. Moving on. Pac-12 refs.
Inconsistent.
Average.
Okay. And the double inferno.
Disappointing.
Yeah, cold.
All right. So, last thing, Rivals says ASU wins. Not on the field, but in recruiting. Had the best November of any school in the country. Landing guys like N'Keal Harry and Chase Lucas will help that. Obviously, we got some help on the defensive line and a 2017 commit to help in the defensive backfield. What does it mean for the program to have a better recruiting month than any school in the country in the midst of a 6-6 season?
I think it means a lot. I like to transform myself back into the East Coast. And if I'm an East Coast guy, am I hearing about ASU right now? And I think I am. If I'm an 18-year-old, 17-year-old kid, I think there's a buzz about what the Sun Devils are doing, especially with social media. You read about some of these recruits, and some of them, a lot of them know one another from 3,000 miles away. Todd Graham is a winner, regardless of what the one-loss record is this season. He's a guy that I think people want to play for. So, yeah, I'm not terribly surprised that ASU has this momentum rolling into 16-17.
He hit such a bomb of a home run this year in recruiting, and in November, like, it wasn't just, you know, one of those shots over Yankee Stadium short porch. He hit like a 500-foot monster that would make Giancarlo Stanton jealous. And, you know, it is so ridiculous what Todd Graham pulled off in the midst of a 6-6 season, when at one point people were discussing, like, is it a problem for recruiting with all the fans leaving at halftime? Todd Graham didn't even have to answer that question. N'Keal Harry commits, the number 2 wide receiver in the country. I don't think that ASU's ever had a commit that high ever.
That's so true. That's very true.
This is a school that produced Terrell Suggs. So, like, I mean, it's absolutely bananas what Todd Graham was able to accomplish on the recruiting trail.
And Tempe is a destination place. I mean, people want to be out here. I mean, we
yes,
talked
young
about,
males.
I mean, the whole student body scenario. So they're always going to have that going for them. And when you put a coach in place who, as I'm going to say, is a true winner in Todd Graham, you're going to get those recruits.
So, quick question. Do they have the number 1 recruiting month in the country without Adidas? How much did Adidas factor in?
I don't think it did a whole lot. I mean, you obviously have all the major schools have some type of shoe/apparel deal. I don't necessarily know if it was Adidas. I think if they were still Nike, I think they still would have pulled that off. So I can't give credit to Adidas for this one.
Yeah, I kind of agree with what Brett said, but I got to be honest. Chase Lucas told me himself how much he loves the uniforms that ASU's been putting out there, how much he loves the cleats, and how much he loves the jerseys. But Chase is a hometown kid, so I feel like, you know, to Brett, to a testament to what Brett said, if it would have been Nike, we still would have gotten Chase. I do kind of think outside of Arizona, maybe the switch hurt ASU a little bit, but we're winning and it's all good. Like, Adidas, Under Armour, Nike, whatever.
Right, that's
ASU brand that's taking care of it all right now.
All I know is every time they play and every time they got a new combination, you get on Twitter and you can pull up, just type ASU unis into the search bar and you're going to see a bunch of fire emojis, hundreds of tweets deep. So, all right, so let's transition real quick before we end this week's podcast. Basketball. Arizona State, 4-2. They're going to play Creighton tonight. Obviously, by the time anybody hears this podcast, the result of that game is going to be over. I saw that Creighton was favored by 6.5 in that game. I feel like Creighton at home could probably maybe pull a double-digit win on Arizona State just from what I've seen so far. But they're 4-2. They're working on getting these new JUCO kids involved, whether it's Obi Aleka or Andre Spite. You know, they've got, you know, Jerry Blake's doing what he can. Cody Justice looks pretty good. Eric Jacobson hit a game winner the other night. It's six games in, and I know six games doesn't matter that much, but how can we grade Bobby Hurley's performance so far?
I give him an A. The guy is 10 points away from being undefeated, and it took overtime in Brooklyn to, you know, kind of deal him one loss.
Overtime and some interesting calls.
Right, and the loss to Sacramento State, I think, was an aberration of, like, what's...
And Sacramento State was no slouch.
Right. They played tough. Mm-hmm. They would have beat a couple teams in the Pac-12 that night. That particular
night. Everybody in the Pac-12 is losing. Everybody in the Pac-12 is losing.
That's true. Yeah. I'll give him a B+, just because it's real early. Like we said, six games and seven games after this podcast tonight. Overall, I like what we're seeing. I like the fact that they were in that, I'm going to say the Barclays Classic, whatever it's called in my hometown, but playing Marquette and NC State early, those are the type of games, win or lose, that you need to have under your belt in November in order to have the success in March.
No, I hear you on that. I just think, man, Bobby Hurley's got this program trending up.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, he's 10 points away from being undefeated.
And that's awesome. That's a terrific stat.
I don't even know when the last time anybody was really excited about ASU basketball was. And, you know, I'm on campus all the time. And kids are talking about it. Kids are wearing the gear. Kids are hyped. And, like, they're like, hey, who's going to the ASU basketball game? I'm trying to go. So, like, you know, I like it. I dig it, man. Like, I got to give him an A. He's got everybody jazzed up about it. He's putting the product out there on the court. I'm thrilled.
And ASU's probably, I mean, they're already they're going to be bringing in four impact players next year, two recruits that have signed on the dotted line, and two transfers from Buffalo. So he's awesome. Already set the program up for success moving forward. And then we've got some potentially big recruiting news coming. Stay tuned to devilsdigest.com, and we'll make sure that you have that information. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this week's Devil's Junkie podcast. We're going to leave you with a little bit of a suggestion from guys who I know like to go out and have a good time. Give us a recommendation, Brett, where to get some grub this weekend.
Oh, that's a good one. Tempe, Chandler, where are we going?
You're out in the Gilbert Chandler border. What's out there?
I'm a fan of Blue 32. There are several locations. There is one in the middle of nowhere where you guys like to say that I live.
But
more so, there's also one in Phoenix, one in Scottsdale as well. There's four throughout the valley. Great food.
I'm going to go with Marley's. There's a Marley's everywhere. There's one in Chandler. There's one in Old Town Scottsdale. There's even one up in Flagstaff for all our ASU fans that listen that are up there. And also, like, there's one at Desert Ridge. So go there. They got great food. Tons of screens everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, go there, catch a game, you know, let them know Chili sent you.
All right, thanks, guys. And I want to give a special shout-out to our support system over at devilsdigest.com, our friends at Speak of the Devils podcast, Nick Kruger, who's done absolutely great work for us this
year.
Fabian Ardaya, who's fantastic. Dom Catronio. Everybody who's contributed to everything that we've done this football season. We look forward to bringing you plenty of content, and we'll keep it going throughout the basketball season and beyond.
I was living in a devil town. I didn't know it was a devil town. Oh Lord, it really brings me down about the devil town.